Hey folks, welcome to the Brilliant Body Podcast, a forum to learn about and liberate the brilliance of your body and ultimately to expand the meaning and experience of intelligence. Join me, Ali Mazay, and other body masters to explore pioneering and varied perspectives on what it means and feels like to be embodied. So many people feel disconnected from their bodies due to emotional or physical pain or even conditioning and lack of education. Others feel quite at home in their bodies yet want to learn to have more pleasure, awareness, and access to the body's guidance. This podcast is for everybody. Each one of my trailblazing guests has studied their own bodies and others' bodies for decades and will share their expertise and unique mission, how to thrive as a body. So join us and reclaim your body's brilliance. So we'll just go ahead and start by welcoming you, Sarah Payton, to the Brilliant Body Podcast live Q&A event. It was such a pleasure and so scintillating to have you on episode 4. And we got such fantastic feedback. And of course, I always have more questions that I want to ask you. So some of this is quite selfish of just getting you back to ask you a few more questions myself and then opening it up to the community to get to interface with you directly. People can easily find out all about you. So all I'm going to say about you is that you are this world-renowned neuroscience educator, nonviolent communicator, and trainer, and family constellation communicator and trainer and facilitator and all around beautiful human being. So thank you so much for being here with us. And I'd love to invite you to do a little process to take us through how we can be a body even more fully than we already are. So Sarah, please have your way with us.
Oh, thank you so much, Ali, and welcome. Welcome, everyone. Welcome, everybody in our bodies. Welcome, everybody in our unembodied state, wherever we are. Welcome. And I want to talk for a moment just about play before I take you into the process, to say that humans are the only species that, and then I think about dolphins. I think dolphins play for their entire lifespan. Humans are one of the few species that play for their entire lifespan. Many species play when they're little and then stop playing as they get older. But humans have this capacity to play through the entire lifespan. But humans and all other animals who play, a characteristic of play is that if anybody gets hurt, we take our ball and go home. So what I'd like to invite you to is the possibility that the experience of not being fully embodied is one where you kind of took your ball and went home away from your own body. So as you begin to breathe, as you begin to notice yourself as a breathing being, see if you can kind of bring a sense of the sensation of your breath then see what it's like to find the ball that you took and went home with. See where you have it tucked away. And for whatever little or big self it was who tucked the ball away, I'll just invite you to notice that little or big one had a specific actual experience of something that wasn't safe or something that didn't feel right or a way that people didn't listen to your nose. Or a way that you just had this sense of, like, my ball's not very welcome. So of course I'm going to tuck it away. So as we bring our attention to this part of the self that has tucked us away, I'm just acknowledging the protection and the care and the tenderness. And see what it's like just to be in this body, acknowledging all of the complex, wonderful reasons that you have for having turned down the volume on your embodiment. And being just like a gentle acknowledger of your body's experience. See what happens with the tension in your shoulders as you say, oh yeah. You have very good reasons for being as you are. The area around your heart, the protective pericardium. See what happens if you say, oh yes, of course. With this kind of warm acknowledgement where the voice that's doing the acknowledgement is bigger than the part of the self that has to be protected or the protector. Noticing, appreciating, and then what's happening for me is I notice there's a part that's like, let me out of here. This like really playful part that wants to come forward now that there's been acknowledgement of the tender protectiveness. And just see what it's like to say, oh, just to welcome that part as well, that all the parts of ourselves are welcome. That all the voices are welcome, that all the intentions are welcome, that all the motivations are welcome. Each of them has a good reason, that each of them matters. And with the part, whatever parts have come forward to be also acknowledged, as well as those that have been tucked away, just see, how does it feel to be in your body? Not as a simple being, as a complex, multifaceted, multi-layered, multi-directional being that has the luck of being converged in this particular physical embodiment. And just see how your shoulders feel, how your pericardium feels, how the armoring in your stomach feels, or the softness in your belly feels. The experience of moving into your hips, if you're somebody who enjoys being in your pelvic floor, how's your pelvic floor doing? Just saying hello to everything. And now bringing your attention back to your breath. The inhale, the exhale. And finally, if you're willing and you're interested, you can put your view on gallery view. And you can open your eyes if you'd like to. And you can look at the faces that have their cameras on. And as you look at the faces that have their cameras on, just notice how your nervous system does. So there will be a different response to each face. But what we're doing when we look at faces from a place of a little bit of safety is we're really inviting our nervous systems into a deeper relationship with safety and with presence, with being in social engagement. The whole experience is one of kind of moving towards being who we are. It's wonderful to see your faces. Thank you very much. There we are, Allie.
It's amazing how much closer to agelessness I feel by recalling these mostly younger aspects that were very good at play. So thank you for reminding me that all is not lost. And though just today I was noticing that I do not play enough and lamenting that. So thank you. That was perfect. Appreciate it. So I have a few questions. that I've been itching to ask you for a while. And then I'm going to turn it over to all of you folks who I'm so happy are here. And the first one, Sarah, is I've been really chewing on the difference between dissociation and disassociation because they can be used interchangeably. And I've always been using dissociation because my understanding was that it was about disconnecting from ourselves. But then, of course, that begs the question, what is ourself? And when I looked up the definition, it talked about it being a specifically psychological split. Whereas disassociation can be a disconnection from anything. So I'm wondering when people are not feeling themselves as a body, when people are not feeling themselves as present, whether that is a disconnection from one's psychology, whether it's more likely to be a disconnection from the body, whether there can be even a distinction between those two things, and therefore the words really are interchangeable. So I'm curious whether you use both those words, and if so, when and why.
I use both words interchangeably because I figure if we're disconnecting from our bodies, we're disconnecting from everything. But I have this really interesting graphic that I use that shows six different kinds of dissociation. So, what's so interesting with dissociation is that we can actually track different areas in the brain that are impacted by a flood of endogenous opioids. So, if you can't figure out what to say, the endogenous opioids have flooded your prefrontal cortex and your speech centers. There's another kind of dissociation that I'll talk about in just a moment. But if you can't feel your body, the endogenous opioids have flooded your brainstem and your para-aqueductal gray. So, different kinds of dissociation, different kinds of floods of endogenous opioids are experienced differently by human bodies. And then there's another kind of dissociation, which is left right hemisphere, where we just don't enter the right hemisphere at all. And we just stay away from that insula that will tell us about our body sensations and how we're doing. And we just hang out in the get things done brain. I'm just gonna get things done. And that also keeps us from play because the experience of spontaneous play is where you're really aware of another human and their body and your own simultaneously. So, depending on what level of play you're doing, then you're just, when you're embodied, you're just all in. And it can be an all in physical play, it can all be all in sexual play, it can be all in emotional, cognitive stuff. Like sometimes the kinds of things that happen in constellations are very rich and embodied and surprising and spontaneous. And of course, sometimes that can go into physical play, or sometimes that can go into even a sense of deep, intense sexuality. When I was in menopause, I hadn't had a period in 3 years. I was representing fertility and I was like, whoa. And my blood started. I was like, wow, this is deep play. It's a spontaneous body experience of participation. I'm blushing a little bit because I don't usually talk about my experience of menstruation, but there we are.
What you just said is, I immediately thought of the effect of screen time and
Oh, yeah.
how that tends to keep me definitely in that left side of existence, that it makes it very hard to play. I don't know if people who game, whether that does something different, it must, to the brain where you're playing, but you're also in that super focused way. But the more time I spend on screens, the less I tend to play. So I gather there's a correlation there.
Right. Well, it's just so interesting, isn't it? Because they're starting to do these AI game things where you have the 3D experience and your body's hooked up to the gaming console. And so there's something happening where we're beginning to bring embodiment into the gaming world in a different way. And that'll be real interesting to see what happens with people. Oh, that'll be very interesting.
Yeah, and whether people are actually feeling their flesh bodies or whether they're feeling sort of an avatar fantasy of their body, I don't know. I'll have to try it one of these days.
It's so interesting.
It is interesting. Okay, so Flo and I were talking this morning about caffeine and sugar. And we specifically wanted to ask you about those two things. She and I are both highly sensitive to both of them and don't use one of them. She doesn't use either. I have fallen to the sugar fiend a lot in these last many years, but caffeine is something I can barely tolerate at all. So I'm just curious about, we're curious about what is that doing to the brain circuits? Why are people so attracted to either or both? Please illuminate for us what the hell's going on, because there's such addictive substances, as we know, and a lot of people are profoundly identified with one or both.
Yeah, wow. Personally, I can't have caffeine either, but there's no research anywhere that shows that caffeine is bad for us. But one of the things that it does, like all dopamine stimulators, there's also, I think, some chemicals in coffee that do this as well, is it takes the default mode network and like chiropractically adjusts it into into a network of being ready for life. But it's, as all dopamine centered substances do, it kind of pulls us into the instrumental brain, out of relational space, out of spontaneous play. You know, it's got all those qualities that are connected with the 20th century and getting things done. Many of the artists of the 20th century used dexedrine to get their things done. W.H. Auden used dexedrine to edit and edit and edit his poetry into that gorgeous crystalline structures that it has. Bob Fosse used dexedrine to edit and edit and edit his choreography and his films when he was editing the films. So there's like this requirement for focus that was kind of the epicenter of the 20th century in so many ways, which I'm hoping that we're starting to move out of a little bit. But caffeine allows people to move into their daily life brain very quickly and easily. So that's an interesting thing. Then this thing about sugar is also so interesting, because we're supposed to have a certain amount of community. Our bodies are supposed to be in embodied community spaces where our bodies are really welcome. Why is there a saying supposed to? I'm saying supposed to because, first of all, a lot of us don't get to be in those community spaces where our body is really welcome. But what we know is that our bodies function much better when we're in community spaces where our body's really welcome. Our immune system functions better, our brain functions better, we see faces more clearly, our voice comes alive. All this social engagement stuff happens when we have both a sense of belonging and mattering, and we have people with us. Oh my God, we have little neurotransmitters in our skin that are dedicated to feeling body heat. They don't feel the heat of the sun, they don't feel the heat of the furnace or the fire. They only alert when we're within the heat range of human bodies. So our companion animals actually are within that heat range, so they give us a lot of comfort. So here we are. These human bodies trying to make it through without the community. In order to make it through without the community, we need more blood glucose. We need more blood glucose in order to be able to maintain homeostasis and body temperature and energy levels. So the less that we have community, the more we need glucose. And that'll come from sugar. It's a real easy way to get sugar. But then there's two elements of sugar. One is that it does help to resolve the deeper soul level loneliness. It is a remedy, it is a medicine for soul level loneliness. The other thing that it does is it helps us to manage this artificially elevated blood glucose level that we have to maintain in our aloneness. Whenever the blood glucose starts to fall, then the brain says, we need the sugar, we need the sugar, we need the sugar. So that's not exactly an addictive process. That's like a homeostatic process. And then there can be an addictive process that's like, I'm really lonely. I just had to deal with all this stuff that's really hard, and my life is really hard, and I need a little sweetness in it. So bring on the sugar. So sugar is complex. And one of the things that we can do is to eat in ways that really even out the blood sugar, because the more that blood sugar is even out, the less craving there is on the homeostatic level. Then we know what part of it is addiction and what part of it is the homeostatic effort to stay steady. You're nodding at me. How are you doing now?
Oh, it's brilliant. I completely relate to everything you just said, and it sheds a lot of light for me. So thank you. And Julie just wrote in the chat, "This makes me curious about meds for ADHD management!" Exclamation point.
Yeah, me too. Now, I'm doing a webinar on dopamine and glutamate tonight. One of the things that I was looking at breakfast this morning, because I like to read research at breakfast, is I was looking at the links between the dopamine system and the endocannabinoid system. So many people don't even know that we have this profound system of homeostatic balance, which is regulated by the brains and the body's endogenous cannabinoids, which is CBD, which is, it's marijuana. Marijuana is the old word, but it's weed. I can never figure what people say now. Cannabis, I guess you're supposed to say. So we have our own internal cannabis system, and it is supported by warmth and play. That's what helps to bring us homeostasis. It turns out that the endocannabinoid system potentiates the dopamine system. So our energy arises from and is regulated from and is supported by warmth and play. And our warmth and play is also mutually supported by the flow of dopamine and getting things done. So there's such a wonderful interweaving in the body. It's just so surprising to me about endocannabinoids being involved in the dopamine system. Who knew? Most of the reason we don't know this is because the US made research into the endocannabinoid system illegal because they were making weed illegal. So then they forbade all research into anything to do with cannabis. Any cannabis had to be illegal, which means that Israel took the lead about 12 years ago and started to investigate the endogenous cannabinoids. And then all this new, really complex information is coming out. So to come back to ADHD, ADHD is an imbalance of dopamine. And there can be a number of ways that we arrive at an imbalance of dopamine. And one of them is probably genetic, that there's some contribution from generation to generation that takes us toward ADHD. But there's also a contribution that can be made by trauma. So, for those of you who are alerting to that, the wonderful book Scattered Minds by Gabor Mate is a primer on the relationship between trauma and ADHD. And of course, the meds for ADHD management are medications that stimulate the production of dopamine that allow us to have more choice about our focus. And that brings us back to dexedrine and the possibility that Bob Fosse indeed had undiagnosed and untreated ADHD. What a brilliant man. What a crazy man. So there we are. There we are. Julie, you can come off mute if you want to and ask any more. I might have missed the brunt of your question, or you might have more thoughts.
I guess I've just been trying to think about the bigger picture. There's all these complex systems and situations going on. So when I think about this type of medication, which, I don't really know ADHD meds that well. But when I think about it, I'm trying to think about it within the scope of all these systems and all this balance to pay attention to. And where does that medication fit in is kind of this bigger question that I'm sitting with. So when you were bringing up the effects of sugar and the effects of caffeine, I was like, well, what are the properties of this kind of medication? And how does that work with being a human?
Yeah, what a great question. Well, a lot of people say once they get their ADHD meds, they're like, oh, I feel normal for the first time in my life. I can choose what I'm thinking about. Part of what happens with ADHD is that the default mode network becomes even more intrusive than it already is. And for those of us who are beginning to have gray hair, the default mode network also becomes more intrusive as we age. So we develop more tendencies towards ADHD as we get older. Yeah, so here we are being little humans and having our attention fractured. Our attention can be fractured by organic brain stuff, and our attention can be fractured by the experience of living in really scary environments where it's not safe to focus. And in order to focus, people have to hyperfocus in order to be able to manage their attention at all. So to come back to gaming, one of the things that turns off the default mode network is first-person shooter video games. Speaking of moving into a disembodied, embodied space, that turns the default mode network off entirely and allows folks with ADHD to be able to direct their attention where they want to into the video game. So ADHD meds stimulate the system, the seeking system, the system that's trying to get things done. So ADHD meds, I think it's so interesting that people say, I feel normal. I think there's kind of a thing where ADHD meds allow us to move into those values of hard work and diligence, whereas ADHD is kind of like, well, where's my brain going now? Oh, now I'm remembering when I was in third grade. Oh, now I'm thinking about my next door neighbor. Oh, now I'm remembering I'm supposed to make some muffins. Oh, I have to clean the toilet first. Oh, here I am. Oh, I've got an appointment in 5 minutes. Oh, look, it's 6 minutes later. Where did that time go? Let me get to the computer and get on that appointment. So that's the kind of brain that somebody has where we don't get to direct our attention. And it's exhausting, it's hard on folks. And so the medication can be a huge relief. And the medication stimulates the production of dopamine and it helps to compensate for a brain that's struggling with dopamine issues and attention. Julie, did that come a little closer to where your wondering was?
Yeah, I think so. Thank you.
Very good.
Yeah, sir, I wanted to add that I have some beloved people in my life who manage their hyperfocus or lack of focus with fast-moving vehicles, exercise, and danger.
Yeah.
I'm curious about those three elements that I've observed many times in people who tend to be very brilliant.
Yeah.
Very, use the word scattered.
Yeah. Fast moving vehicles, danger, and intense exercise. Yeah. Oh, well, I mean, in some ways, my speculation about ADHD is that it's a perfectly natural manifestation of being human that was created in order for us to have people who were able to drive fast. And I think another ADHD profession can be airline control in the tower, the airline towers. Yeah.
Traffic control. Yeah. And Gil just mentioned, is it possible that ADHD heredity is a Neanderthal trait or similar ancient tribe?
Totally possible. I've never seen that research, but it's a great speculation. Because certainly for a hunter, ADHD is fine. It's like being in the video game. You know, you're in the environment, you're listening for the animals, you're watching for tracks, you're noticing everything, you're doing what you need to do. And it's our 20th century that kind of made that a no-no. So fast cars, intense exercise, danger, they allow the brain to have an external focus that helps to manage and quiet the default mode network, all three of those. Yeah.
Fantastic. I have one more question and then we'll turn it over. You mentioned in episode 4, and it went by quite quickly, and when I was listening to it again today, it really popped out at me. You were talking about true needs and how easy it is to lose our contact and our awareness of our true needs, let alone our capacity or our ability to name them and express them and claim them. And I'd love to hear you speak about the relationship or lack thereof between our true needs and addiction and tendencies towards addiction and trying to compensate for that disconnect with our needs through substances or behaviors.
Yeah. Well, one of the things to say about addiction is we've already begun actually to open the door to thinking about addiction. By starting to think about dopamine, which is a contributory neurotransmitter for all addictive processes. What's so interesting about our addictions, though, are just like cannabis and endocannabinoids, every single addictive substance has a corollary internal substance in the brain. We are truly children of this world. We belong to this planet. The substances that are psychoactive that come from the plants of our planet are the substances that are also inside of our brains. So amphetamines stimulate the production of dopamine, which addresses the seeking system. Sugar, salt, fat, and the opiates stimulate the production of our endogenous opioids. Cannabis stimulates the production of endogenous cannabinoids, which are linked with the play circuit, the play system. Fear is linked with benzodiazepines, with diazepine, the endogenous diazepines. And so when we're afraid, when we're anxious and afraid, if we take benzodiazepines, it helps us. If we're lonely and anxious, then we'll take opiates and they'll help us. So it depends on what circuit is not getting the support that it needs internally from our internal systems or from our community systems, then we turn towards those particular drugs. And Gil writes about magic mushrooms. Magic mushrooms are, as far as we know, not particularly addictive, but stimulate the flow of serotonin. And also magic mushrooms and other hallucinogenic substances quiet the default mode network to the point where something really different can happen in the brain. Like video games take us out of the default mode network so we don't have to be tortured by it. But the psychoactive substances, magic mushrooms, ayahuasca, and peyote, they actually completely disable the default mode network, which is the automatic voice of the brain that kind of holds all of our stories about who we are. So there's a dismantling of stories about the self that happens with the psychoactive drugs that allows people to see their lives in a really different way. So I'm very interested in the use of those drugs. MDMA is also being used in that way. Also, there are people developing therapies that use weed, that use cannabis in that way as well, to work with attachment specifically, which is interesting because what's needed to regulate the endogenous cannabinoids is warmth, which is the essence of attachment. Is there warmth or is there not warmth? So, yeah, I may have forgotten some because there are eight circuits. There we are with.
We'll put your brain circuit materials in the notes so people can get to those. This is so fantastic. I'm loving this conversation. Thank you so much, Sarah. Flo just wrote, are there alternatives that can be used to substitute these things to help stimulate those networks, like fruit instead of sugar, for example?
So fruit actually is not very different from sugar in the way that it impacts us. So we can use fruit homeostatically to try to keep our blood sugar levels artificially high. So fruit is just a slightly different kind of sugar that helps to compensate for missing community. The alternatives that I really like are what happens to the brain as we begin to be really warm and interested in our own selves, not in a narcissistic way, but in a self-regulated, securely attached way, like waking up in the morning and imagining giving yourself kisses on your own head, you know, I mean, just radical, radical self-warmth is what I'm really interested in and how that changes many of these networks. But other people experiment with other things, like Ali mentioned fast driving danger and intense exercise to help regulate the dopamine system. And that's it. Those are alternatives. And then, of course, all of the drugs that doctors prescribe, I mean, not all of them, but trying to balance out nervous systems, it's not actually particularly effective, but doctors will try all kinds of alternatives to try to help people when they're suffering from the after effects of PTSD and from ADHD and from the impacts of trauma. For some reason, as I was reading this article this morning about the relationship between dopamine and endogenous cannabinoids, what I thought of was my son, who I think I can turn this so that you can see my son who died. You can, oh, there. He's on the wall there, those black and white pictures. His name was Ben. And I've always said that he died of alcoholism. But for some reason, realizing the article that I was reading was endogenous cannabinoids, dopamine, and PTSD. And I realized, oh my God, my son died of PTSD. He was an adopted kid and came from a really, really rough childhood that caught up with him and killed him. He was using the alcohol to try to manage intrusive memory and PTSD. And at that time, we weren't able to find anything that really was effective. We tried all kinds of medications to try to manage the PTSD. I didn't have my unconscious contract process yet, which might have helped him a little bit. But what really would have helped him, I think, would have been to have had him do psychedelics pretty early on, to have him do psilocybin, the magic mushrooms, early on, or to have him do ayahuasca early on. At that time when he died, ayahuasca was still largely being done in South America. And he was at that point dying of the alcohol and couldn't even travel for 3 hours somewhere, let alone be on a plane for 7 hours. And so I feel that he might have been saved if I'd had access to what's starting to become more easily accessible now with psilocybin journeys and ayahuasca journeys. Did I do anything to answer your question at all, Flo? How are you doing there?
Yeah, I guess perhaps I was looking for if there's alternatives if I don't want to drive a fast car or do drugs or take sugar. I mean, the fruit instead of sugar is just an example, but I was looking for more maybe tamer solutions, but alternative.
Yeah. For me, because of course I've got my own ideas about what our brains need, I'd see what happened with a year of really radical self-warmth and trauma healing, which is maybe not tamer than fast cars. Sort of depends on.
I'm okay with fast cars, but I just didn't think it was going to solve everything. Thank you.
Yeah.
One
Yeah,
of
go
the
ahead.
things that I'm appreciating as you're talking about the power and the gift of psychedelics to help people expand their sense of identity, and that a lot of what is healing is for people, and of course, we hear, and perhaps some of us have experienced that sense of being merged with the all or greater than the suffering, smaller self that one might be ashamed of or struggling with all the time. And I'm appreciating how constellation work can also have this capacity to help us have this meta perspective on ourselves. And just curious if you wanted to say anything about that. So that may or may not be also woven into this question of the commonalities of hallucinogenics and representing in constellation work or just being a part of a communal healing experience. Is it Jill or Gil? Maybe it's Jill for Jillian.
Yes, sorry, I'm Jill for Gillian, you're right.
Jill, yeah. Is falling into limerence part of this?
This word looks very beautiful and I've forgotten what it means. What's limerence again?
It's when you fall just hopelessly in love, and that's the story of my life. I don't just like someone, I end up with a really bad crush, and the object of my affection probably isn't worth it, but it doesn't stop me. I just imagine I go into this dopamine thing and I can't get out of it again.
Well, it wouldn't just be dopamine. Dopamine would definitely be involved, but it would also be oxytocin. The engagement that you experience sounds like the experience of the baby's communion with the mother in the womb and after birth. What do we know about your, it might be private, so to say, oh no, it's private, we won't go there.
I was rejected by my mother very early on, and I was away from the family, living with a grandma a long way away for about 3 years, and then returned to my mother, who never bonded with me. I mean, I don't know why she did that. She had loads of children. When I came back, she got another one, and she got another one on the way, but she had five of us. But for some reason, she just didn't like the sight of me. She could have been postnatal depression or something. I just don't know. Yeah. And I spent my life trying to get her attention and her love, and never really. Well, I did. The last day she was alive, she told me that she loved me and she always had done. But that wasn't how she behaved towards me at all. That was the day she actually died, even though no one knew she was going to die that day. But no, I recognised there was something missing from my life.
Yeah.
And I always kind of blame that. But now I'm wondering, is it to do with ADHD?
Well, if you'd like to, we could time travel to the baby.
Yeah.
To your baby self.
Yeah.
Would you like that?
Yeah.
Okay. So if we step through time and space, are you already, is it already happening when you're in the womb? Does the womb feel cold? Or is it after you've come out? Or is it as you're crowning, as your head is crowning into the world? What's your sense of where we find you?
I mean, my mum just wanted to have loads of babies, but she didn't really know how to look after us. So it may have started as soon as I was born. I mean, I'm sure I was looked after very well by my grandma.
Yeah.
My brothers and sisters have got either ADHD or some kind of trauma.
Yeah.
Two of them died already. So she singled out me as being the ugliest baby she'd ever seen. And
oh, that's good.
And really horrible things to me as I was growing up.
Yeah,
but the first 3 years of my life, I didn't spend with her anywhere. I spent with a grandma.
Mm.
So there would have been a separation, I guess, yeah.
Yeah. So you and I, then, stepping through time and space to catch the baby Jill as she's being born. So we step through time and space, and we just kind of put your mom in a golden bubble. And we put the nurses in a golden bubble, and we put the doctor in a golden bubble if she had a hospital birth, or the midwife in a golden bubble.
Yeah, she did, yeah. I was born in the hospital, yeah.
Yeah. So we're just pausing all those clanking and the bright lights, and we're turning the lights down. And here's this baby Jill crowning out of her mother's body. And we get to catch this baby instead of the world, the other people in the world catching this baby. You and I get to catch this baby.
Mm-hmm.
And so as she comes out, just let yourself catch her. And how is it to catch her?
Well, she's gorgeous.
Oh, yeah. What a wonder. So we get to swaddle her with warm flannel and bring her right to, so she's got skin to skin contact, and so that her little heavy weight is just, you know, she can feel gravity now. She can feel herself being held. And what does your body do catching her? How is your embodied being with being the one to welcome this little one?
Well, I feel very proud that, you know, that I've got that privilege of this beautiful little girl.
Yeah. So gathering her up and saying to her, you survived this life. This was very difficult. This was a very difficult childhood. And you made it through. I am here.
Yeah, no, I'm a survivor. I am a survivor. I know that.
Yeah. And if she wants to come home with you, instead of having to live this babyhood and this childhood again, she's done that. You've been there, done that. Does she want to come home with you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, so then stepping through time and space and letting her, I often have a sense with these baby parts that they just kind of melt into my heart and just stay there, kind of nestled, sleeping, playing, laughing. Does she want to go into your heart?
Yeah.
So this is the first part of the experience of communion, restoring communion, because that's what got ruptured. And so when we really begin to understand that communion is a need, it's a true need, to come back to Ali talking about what needs are true needs, communion is a true need. What happens when I say, Well, of course you've been in limerence, falling into limerence, because you've been looking for this true need of communion. How do your cells do as we talk about that?
Yeah, thank you. That's really helpful, actually. I do spend my life trying to be part of communities. I don't always succeed. I know that, but people are really important to me. I've got my own beautiful little girl who's like 30s now, but, you know, having my own little girl was very restorative for me. And I've never not loved her, not even for a minute. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Jill. It's so lovely to get to do something with depth and meaning here for our circle. If you were touched in some way by Jill's work, just say how you were touched or moved, if you're willing. We'll catch her again. Our circle then will catch her coming back from the birth process if you speak. Yeah. So Julie writes, "I'm moved by the work in the gentleness and presence." And Allie has shared reality. So there was this something similar that happened to Allie. And Julie was moved by love. I'd love to hear one of your voices, at least besides mine, to come off mute and say what gift you received from this, just to help catch Jill. Yeah, Jean, please.
Jill, that's a beautiful reminder of how we can change the story and recreate something that is far more nurturing than the original experience. So thank you for that.
And thank you, Sarah. That was so lovely.
Is there anybody else who'd like to ask a question of Sarah? Riva, was that a hand? Good.
I was going to add to blessings for Jill for being in that beautiful space of seeing you come into the world and being able to catch her and have Sarah there with you is just very touching. I appreciate it very much.
Anybody else like to ask a question? Or yeah, Jean, go ahead.
Sarah, you've touched on alcohol a couple of times and genetics with regards to ADHD and alcoholism. And alcoholism in particular seems to have such strong, I don't know if it's genetic, but familial lines. And I mean, certainly, I think many of us have done constellation work around it. And I just wonder if you could say something else about that thread that seems to run through so many families.
Well, alcohol is the very best all-purpose substance for humans to solve every single system problem. Every single circuit problem is solved by alcohol. Not enough energy? Alcohol. Poor access to sexuality? Alcohol. Poor access to joy and play? Alcohol. Poor access to warmth? Alcohol. Too much fear? Alcohol. So, I mean, I'm laughing just because I appreciate it. I appreciate the magic of alcohol as an all-purpose medicine. But certainly, you know, as from my own story, it can be extraordinarily destructive. And there is work that's been done on the genes of alcohol, of vulnerability to alcoholism. As far as I know, that research has not been integrated into the systems theory from Yakupangsep. So what we're really thinking about with the genetic transmission of alcohol is we have a question. The question is, to what extent is this a systems problem that's being transmitted from generation to generation? And then alcohol is the remedy. It's the family chosen remedy for this systems problem. Is there a problem in constellation work? Of course, we talk about the flow of love and disruptions to the flow of love brought about by collective trauma or personal trauma. And so when a family line has the flow of love disrupted, it doesn't really restore easily by itself. It sounds like in some ways, Jill was able to restore a flow of love or almost to restart a flow of love. But it also sounds, Jill, like it came from your grandmother too, that she did love you. Is it okay that I'm referencing your work? I'm sorry, I did it without consent. I was just lost in thought there. So if the flow of love is disrupted in a family, maybe the family's remedy is alcohol, rather than that the family is doomed to alcoholism. Do you see how that's a different idea? So sometimes I think that can be true. I think sometimes there can be that genetic vulnerability that's real intense, can come from both sides, can lead people to say, well, I'm just not even going to drink at all because it's so strong in my family lines. But I think also it can be like, this is the remedy. I think it's sort of interesting that I come from a line of teetotalers. And when I have alcohol, it makes me feel awful. So I don't think it's choice that my family's chosen not to have alcohol. I don't think it made anybody feel good. So just in my genetics, there's much more of feeling good from sugar. Sugar is like my family's alcohol. Jean, just kind of steer me towards where you want to go here.
Yeah, I certainly recognize the systems problem. Speaking of my own family, diaspora from Ireland.
Right? Oh, yeah.
So the trauma around that certainly played out in familial lines. There's no question about it. And I'm also curious, perhaps people have a genetic predisposition towards alcohol. And then when you introduce trauma into the familial line, then it emerges with the combination of two.
Well, I just wanted to say, since you've mentioned Ireland, that Ali and I have a friend, and some of you may also be acquainted with him, Brendan O'Brien, who does tremendously beautiful constellation work. He works a lot with suicidality in Ireland. And one of the things that he also is, in addition to a constellation facilitator, is he's a master singer of folk songs and of Irish songs. And he knows the songs of Irish immigration, which are so poignant. I brought him to the US to do a workshop that was partly constellations and partly song, so that the descendants, it was for descendants of Irish heritage in the US, so that they could hear the songs, brings me tears, because I'm of Irish descent also. They could hear the songs that spoke to the loss of the land and the loss of the people and the heartbreak that our forefathers lived with, coming to North America from anywhere. And even for many of our indigenous people in North America, they were forcibly moved off the land of their ancestors to Oklahoma or to larger reservation areas. So being torn from the land is like a theme in North America. And in so many indigenous groups, there's less of an ease with alcohol, more genetic vulnerability. And if we think about Ireland, the Irish people were the indigenous people of that land in a different way than in most of the rest of Europe, where there was more movement. So if we touch into that indigeneity also, I think there's an interesting piece about the loss of not just land, not just family, but also of community. That's a collective trauma that then enters the family lines with alcohol and with all kinds of abuse and neglect. And
colonization, like in Scotland,
yeah,
which is famous for its drinking, among
right.
other things. Yeah. Anybody else have a question? Maybe who hasn't spoken yet? You can always type your question in the chat too if you don't want to speak it.
Absolutely. And Jill writes, I've always drank a lot, but never been addicted. I have sugar too. My great-great-grandma was from the diaspora also, all through the female line. In the UK, the people who lived on the land were moved to industrial towns from 1800 onwards. Yes, there's this worldwide divorcing of people from their land. I was having lunch in Korea with a Korean woman, and she said that her family had, now this won't be so surprising to those of you in Europe, but she said there were ancestors from 400 years ago buried on her family's farm in Korea. And I was like, wow, that is some uninterrupted strain of relationship with the land there.
Hi, everyone. My name is Erin. This has been incredibly interesting to listen to. And I think what hits me the most with the difference between the energetics of people who are not displaced and who are land-based. I do a lot of work in remote Indigenous communities in British Columbia, constellation work in particular. in the way that most of us feel as white displaced people is that we actually have to explain that we have ancestors to ourselves and to our clients. Whereas if you said that to an Indigenous person, it would be like saying you have skin.
Yeah.
It's a knowing, it's not a concept. And I think that that baseline loss creates an enormous amount of loneliness and an enormous amount of pressure that somehow, and of course our individualistic societies and culture of that we live in, we're just not backed by anything of positivity. And then many of us don't have immediate relatives that are of the healthy sort, or because of war or displacement or pull from the land, and Christianity and Catholicism and all that creates a lot of blocks of flow for love. And there's a very definite difference in people who understand that they have ancestors, a deep knowing, and those of us who are still in the process of remembering that that support is not only present, but deeply available to us all the time.
It would be fun to have neuroscientists be really interested in constellations and to do like neurotransmitter profiles of people before they realized they had ancestors and after they began to lean into them. Yeah.
Absolutely. Even taking those people who we do constellation in this community, that they've been there for 10,000 years from here.
Mm.
They mean it. Like they look like they're trees. They are incredibly embodied in where they're from. It'd be very interesting to see how our brain waves are different between people who don't have that feeling. And again, before and after that knowledge is offered. Because even if it's offered, you may not incorporate it, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Cool that you're doing that work. Thank you for sharing that.
There's a question in the chat with Julene. What is the word for the kind of research that's going on in Israel but died in the U.S. due to marijuana? Starts with an E, if you could post it here in the chat. Endocannabinoid research. Endocannabinoid research. Right. Started 12 years ago in Israel, now being done globally. Yeah. It is really interesting how cannabis is taking over in a lot of places. And yet it can, I believe in my own personal and just social experience, that it can really have its downside and can easily overtake one's body and brain and life in ways that may or may not be worth the play and the sensuality and the good things that come from it. So wondering if you want to say.
Yeah. I don't think I would be able to find it, but there's this wonderful, wonderful piece of research that was done. I'm not 100% sure the research was done, but it's wonderfully illustrative. There are pictures of different spider webs.
I was thinking that earlier, and I was thinking about it right now when you were talking about caffeine and how supposedly it helps people focus. But if you look at the one for caffeine, there's huge holes and it's a complete slop fest. So I'm so glad you brought that up because I've been meaning to bring that back around.
And the web that's woven by a spider that's been treated with cannabis is incomplete. You could probably Google spiders on drugs and see if they have that effect.
I'll put that in the notes too, for sure. It's a really fascinating one. In fact, when I saw that many, many years ago, decades of 30 years ago, I quit drugs almost immediately after I saw that research. It was so visual and so visceral for me. And I thought, that's not how I want my brain and being and aura to be. So I'm glad you brought that up. Yeah. So another aspect of play, let's talk about sex, because in the episode 4, we barely got to that. Only at the very end did you mention it with such gusto. And it happens to be one of my favorite topics, being a sexologist and also a curious, engaged human being. So just curious what you want to talk about, that topic, that brain circuit, that capacity and potentiality and promise that we all have.
Yeah, well, what Yakpongsep said very enticingly in just like a sentence in his book, The Archaeology of Mind, was that because we become adults with the help of the hormones of the reproductive system, the sexuality circuit, which includes attractive tissue in the brain and then the entire reproductive system, is the road that we travel in order to become the adults that we're meant to be. that it is not just the sexuality circuit, but it is also the emergence circuit, the emergence of authentic self. So there's this incredible link between sexuality and authenticity. And I remember once a constellation that really brought this to mind. Before the pandemic, I used to go into a women's prison regularly, a women's prison south of Portland, Oregon. And I would bring in a group of volunteers. I tried doing constellations in the prison without volunteers. And then I read Dan Booth Cohen's beautiful book about doing constellation work in prisons. The name of it is eluding me in this moment. And what he did was he brought in groups of volunteers with him. He brought 6 to 12 volunteers into the prison with him to do constellation work with the inmates. And he was working in a maximum security prison with murderers and did beautiful constellation work that he describes in this book. It's a wonderful book. So I decided, okay, I'm going to start scheduling my trips into the prison at times when there are students coming to study constellations with me. And so I would bring in different teachers into the prison to do constellations for the women, but I would also bring in students when I was teaching constellations. So Brendan O'Brien from Ireland came into the prison and actually sang the ancient prison songs from Ireland for the women. Gives me goosebumps. They cried. It was very beautiful. He taught them one of the prison songs. But one time when I was the leader of the constellation work, a woman raised her hand and she said, I killed my grandmother and I don't know why. And so we began to set up the constellation and elicit the story of this woman's life. And what had happened was that she had killed her grandmother in an alcohol blackout. She woke up from the blackout, hearing the news being announced on the radio that she had killed her grandma. And she had been in prison for some 5 years and was still in a state of shock. And so as we began to collect the information about her life and it began to come out in the constellation, what we discovered together was that she belonged to a group of fundamentalist Christians. In the United States, the fundamentalist Christians are completely opposed to lesbian and gay sexuality. It's not okay to be a homosexual. These are the groups that create the camps where the children are re-educated in an effort to make them not be homosexual. So she grew up in this environment. She had a similar story to your story, Jill, if I may reference you again. And she was taken in by her grandmother. But her grandmother was fundamentalist Christian. She remembered from kindergarten that she knew she was lesbian. But she tried to push it away. She tried to push it away. She ended up running away when she was 13 to live on the street. And she was in a relationship then, actually, with a much older woman, which, of course, is sexual abuse, and did a lot of drugs and alcohol, and then really missed her family and went back to try to be with her grandmother again and tried to be sober. And that was when she had the blackout experience and ended up realizing that she had killed her grandmother. And so I said to her, it seems that the constellation is calling you to come into a good relationship with your sexuality. And I said, is that something you're willing to do? She said, I can't. She said, I can't. This is the only way I can atone for my grandmother's death is by giving up my sexuality. And which, of course, felt recursive. It felt like more of the same pressure that she was in her difficult fate. This is something I often think about when I'm wondering about the emergence of true self and sexuality, the sexuality circuit and sexuality and our sexual expression. I often think about how inextricable they are and how little we realize that they are inextricable. And the importance of people's own sense of their own both gender expression and sexual expression, that it's just one of the most important things for that to be celebrated. I often wonder about violence against women and the extent to which violence against women comes from men who have turned away from their homosexuality and forced themselves into paired relationships that are not true to their authentic selves. So this is just a starting point. Ali, just ask me a question to help me go wherever's of interest to you.
We only have a couple more minutes, and I'm deeply satisfied by that answer. I will add on just the tail end of that conversation that I have been thinking a lot lately, particularly about why there's so much hatred towards other people's sexuality and other people's gender identity, and why people take other people's experience so personally. And so this gives me more of a clue, more of a sense of if people are struggling with their own emergence and their own sexual identity and or gender identity, then it is more likely to take it out on other people. So,
yeah. And also a very interesting piece of this that we haven't gotten into exactly, but we can touch on and glance off of, is the integration of the disgust circuit and the sexuality circuit. And that the successful integration of disgust and sexuality is a part of becoming a grown-up. And part of what happens is that disgust is protective against too early sexuality. So what we know about sexual abuse is that it negatively impacts the brain, and also that little ones who are sexually abused enter puberty earlier. They're really impacted physically and emotionally and cognitively by sexual abuse. And so disgust is supposed to be protective against too early access to sexuality. And part of the grooming process for pedophiles is a dismantling of the child's disgust response. So disgust is another of the circuits that we haven't talked about, but is very important to health and well-being and to knowing what our no's are and to knowing what we really like. And so as we get a little older, hit puberty, then the disgust begins to retreat in response to the sexuality. And we start to go, oh, French kissing, that was always seemed so gross when we were little. Oh, oral sex, that always seemed so gross when we were little. You mean they do that with their mouths? Oh my God. And then we start to go, oh, that might feel good. That sounds interesting. And that's the beginning of a successful movement that often doesn't happen for kids who are sexually abused. The successful movement doesn't get to happen. They remain frozen and don't get to have that evolution to self-motivated desire and interest. But we can heal from that and restore that, because you work with the sexuality and the disgust circuit and constellations, and just amazing, beautiful things happen. So coming out of that spiral then, another way that's real interesting that happens with disgust and sexuality is all of the fetishes. All the human fetishes are connected to the interplay of disgust and sexuality. Kink has very interesting lines that move into disgust and integrate with sexuality. So there's quite a complex task of maturation that comes with integration and complexity and differentiation of self from other, and differentiation of self and what we desire and what's interesting to us from what society thinks is supposed to be interesting. So there's all kinds of ways in which our sexuality circuit takes us into really, really interesting territory physically and sexually, but also into the territory of becoming our true selves. And what else do I want to say in my last minute? Maybe you'll respond, Ali, and that will help me.
I love this. We could talk about this for hours, Sarah. And I hope this provokes a part two, or part three, as it may be. And some of this we did discuss in episode 4 of the Brilliant Body podcast. So I want to encourage people to listen to that beautiful conversation Sarah and I had some months ago. And of course, I'm going to mention how people can get more of you too, but I wanted to just add a couple things that Aaron said. I've noted a stagnancy to those involved in regular cannabis ingestion. I also think we have different brain chemistries that have medicine in different forms. And Juline, I was once told marijuana left holes in our aura, so I'm curious about the spider study because it supports that idea that I believe for a long time. So we will put links in the show notes, and to be continued. And what a fantastic conversation. I had no idea it would turn into a conversation about sex, drugs, and even a little bit of God. So three fascinating topics. So I want to thank you again, Sarah, for being with us. You're such a brilliant body and brain and being, and I so value you, as it looks like everybody here does. And of course, people can find all the more about you on your website. And I assume people can still get that incredibly generous offer to get almost 75% off on your 8-week self-study online resonant language self-study course.
Summit coming. There's a free play summit where we're bringing together neuroscientists talking about play. And it starts on April 5th. It starts on Friday, April 5th. It's going to be spectacular. We're getting Jaak Panksepp's co-researcher to do a 3-hour specially commissioned research download on play. It's really going to be fun.
All righty. We'll put that in the notes as well. And if anybody's interested in all the beautiful things that I'm doing, particularly my work in sexuality and addiction, you can find me at www.alimezey.com. And then we also have some fantastic other Eventbrites coming up with other guests of the Brilliant Body Podcast. We have Gil Headley coming up, the integral anatomist, who is endlessly inspiring and illuminating. We have the brilliant Rachel Fell, who's a creative strategist and neurodiversity expert, coming up. And we have Amber Gray, the human rights psychotherapist, trauma healer, dance therapist, and mystic, who has been all over the world studying with many wise humans and wise other animals. So I highly recommend that you join those events. And I'm about to start a course on the work that I'm doing that is super focused on the power of spatial relationship. If you're interested in that, please contact me about that too. So if there's anything else you or anybody else would like to say, I think we did our jobs.
It was wonderful to meet you, Allie. Yeah. I honor your work and your voice in the world so much. I'm delighted to be with you.
Thank you. Likewise, Sarah. Thank you all so much for coming and making this conversation possible. So best wishes to everybody. And hopefully we'll see you at the Play Summit, and let's all play some more, a lot more than we've been playing. So
bye for now.
Bye.
Hi, thank you so much.
Hey, brilliant bodies. One last thing before we wrap up. Sarah has so kindly offered an exclusive gift to you. Nearly 75% off her 8-week Introduction to Resonant Language online self-study course. It's already on a 2-for-1 promo too, so you can sign up with a friend. Just use the coupon code BODYBRILLIANCE35 at checkout. After you make your order, add a note in the checkout box or shoot an email to help@sarahpeyton.com. Tell her your friend's email and name, and you're all set for an incredible journey together. You can find the details in the show notes below. And have fun resonating. Thanks so much for sticking around till the end. If you enjoyed this episode, please give that like button a little click. And if you haven't already, make sure to subscribe and hit that notification bell. I've got a bunch of fascinating guests lined up with trailblazing experts in the field that I'm really excited to share with you. I'm eager to hear from you too, so don't be shy. Drop a comment below, share your thoughts, suggestions, or just say hi. Your insights on this episode mean the world to me. So go ahead, spread some love, like, subscribe, hit the bell, and share your thoughts below. Your support keeps this channel going strong, and I'm genuinely grateful for each and every one of you. If you'd like to learn more about the many ways I'm encouraging and guiding the wider world to reclaim the brilliance of the body, please visit my website at www.alimezey.com. Thanks so much for listening. Until the next episode and beyond, reclaim your brilliant body. The Brilliant Body Podcast was created by Ali Mazay. This episode was co-produced and edited by Ali Mazay and Florence Popoff.
thanks to composer Blair, Mr. One Man Band Wilson, for my theme music.